This is COVID Conversations. I'm Erin Ransford, and I'm here with Dr. Ismail Nabil. Dr. Nabil is the Deputy Medical Director of Employee Health, Safety, and Wellness for the Mount Sinai Health System and an Associate Professor in the Department of Environmental Medicine and Public Health at the Icahn School of Medicine. He's a Fellow of the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine and is the current Vice Chair of ACOM's Council on Scientific Affairs. In this series of recordings, we explore a variety of topics surrounding the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus and the COVID-19 disease. Today is January 7th, 2021. Dr. Nabil provides an overview of COVID-19 vaccine side effects and comorbidities. Hello, Dr. Nabil.
Hello, Erin. Good to connect with you again.
Likewise.
The vaccination is ongoing right now, and there are more and more people who are interested in asking about it. And I'm hopeful that in coming months, we will be able to expand the access to vaccination to everyone. That will have significant impact on the disease.
You've received your first dose, which is excellent. Here in Illinois, they haven't yet opened it up for public vaccination, but we're waiting on that day.
Absolutely. And I hope that that comes sooner. So with that, I want to bring up something that I get asked many times. As a physician, my patients ask me, my family members ask me, is vaccination for everyone? What do you think?
I think it's for most people. From what I've read, it sounds like that it's recommended for people even with underlying medical conditions, with the caveat that there hasn't been enough longitudinal data to determine if there are side effects for specific diseases.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So vaccination campaigns or vaccination, mass vaccination, we actually look at a population and try to vaccinate as many people as possible. And the reason behind it is to achieve something called herd immunity. So for COVID-19, we're looking at vaccinating upwards of 70 to 80% of the population for it to control the transmission of disease and control the disease itself. And it's a monumental task.
It is. You see all these news stories of massive delays in the distribution and dissemination of the vaccines throughout the states. And it sounds like that this country is way behind from its goal that was set for number of vaccinations before the end of 2020. And we're starting off the new year already behind.
And that has been a challenge. But one of the things that's even more challenging is people with underlying conditions or have other medical issues. Is it safe to give the vaccine to those individuals? And I know for a fact that as population health experts, public health experts, occupational medicine physicians deal with that question all the time, especially instituting mass vaccination campaigns. For example, in healthcare, we do vaccinate a lot of people in hospital systems. Some of the individuals do suffer from underlying health conditions that puts them at a certain risk for receiving vaccines. So one of the important things that people talk about is having severe allergic reaction. This is not uncommon for a vaccine to manifest severe allergic reaction. And severe in terms of what we call severe is anaphylaxis reaction. When it happens to some of the common ingredients of the vaccine. In cases of COVID-19 vaccine, we are packaging messenger RNA vaccines into an envelope. Lipid-based parts or fat-based parts goes into the packaging of the vaccine. And some individuals might be allergic to those essential ingredients, and they can manifest severe allergic reaction to those parts or components or ingredients of the vaccine. And one of the things that we have learned since we started the vaccination, it's still very uncommon to have that severe allergic reaction.
What are the ingredients that have these adverse allergic reactions?
One of the common ingredients that has been used in vaccines is polyethylene glycol, which has noted to have some level of allergy, or it manifests allergic sort of symptoms in some individuals. The way we will roll out or vaccinate for this disease is completely unprecedented. And that means that we are looking at upwards of millions of people getting vaccinated in a very short amount of time. Having some understanding from flu vaccinations, we do see a very small subset of individuals do manifest those allergic reaction that we were talking about. And in this case, polyethylene glycol, in some instances, we think might be a ingredient some people manifest allergies to. Having allergy to one of the components of vaccine does not make you less immune, or the effect of vaccine does not diminish at all, even if you're allergic to one part or one component of the vaccine. So keep that in mind. Getting vaccinated and having a mild allergic reaction does not really mean that you're not manifesting a response against the virus.
So it's a risk-benefit analysis.
Yeah, more or less, yes. A severe reaction, you consult with your physician or provider or allergist to make sure that this is the right vaccines for you. In some instances, those experts can guide you in terms of getting vaccinated and not having a significant allergic reaction.
So people would know if they're allergic to, say, eggs or milk or something, but most people maybe don't know if they're allergic to, say, polyethylene glycol.
Right. So you're absolutely right. Most individuals don't have a good clue that they might be allergic to a compound such as polyethylene glycol unless they end up getting the vaccines and then manifesting the symptoms. And the other thing is, it's a harder thing to at least elicit unless you go through vaccination. PEG itself, it's polyethylene glycol, which has been an approved component of the vaccine for a very long time. It can occasionally trigger anaphylaxis. It could range from rashes, low blood pressure, fast heartbeats, or sometimes shortness of breath. So there are symptoms that can be missed if we are not fairly cognizant of this impact. So guess what? What we're doing is, as we get our vaccines, at least for healthcare providers, we basically wait about 15, 20 minutes. And the healthcare professional sort of looks at us and makes sure that we're doing well before we leave the vaccination booth.
So any severe reaction like anaphylaxis would occur within 15, 20 minutes?
Correct, yeah. So it's a fairly acute response, and you will see the reaction appearing fairly quickly.
Are there other reactions that may take longer to manifest?
And that's correct, yes. Yeah. So they're long-term reactions, but not as severe as anaphylaxis, which occurs fairly quickly. But sometimes we do see injection site tenderness, malaise, and some people feel a little bit weak after the vaccine, but those goes away over time. And especially during the phase 3 trials, we do look at the side effects. One of the things that I do want to highlight regarding underlying medical condition, the people that we're just talking about allergic reactions, we also need to account for individuals who have underlying health conditions, like weakened immune system. And in our cases, when we are doing mass vaccination across the campus, we do come across with individuals who have weakened immune system. For example, taking a cancer-treating drug or suffering from HIV, that itself is an increased risk for getting COVID-19 disease. But the good news is most of the individuals, even with weakened immune system, can safely take this vaccine. Even though we don't have comprehensive, robust information, what we have seen is that people with those underlying conditions can safely take these. We do know that people with weakened immune system might not be able to mount a response, which individuals with competent immune system does. That's very important to understand. And I think our understanding in this area will continue to evolve as more and more information will be available to make evidence-based decisions.
So are you saying that people with compromised immune systems, the vaccine might not necessarily negatively affect them, but it also may not be as effective as a vaccine because they're not able to build those antibodies?
Yeah, so the mounting that immune response might be limited in those cases. Again, depending on the severity of the disease or if they're taking a cancer-treating medication, those cancer drugs can suppress your immune system significantly. And I also go back to a point where a risk versus benefits, those individuals with weakened immune systems are more likely to be impacted by this disease. So it's very important for us to protect those individuals. So if talking about risk versus benefits, the important thing to understand is even though you're not mounting a good response due to weakened immune system, you're still getting the protection that you need to prevent this severe disease that can potentially kill you. So I think risk versus benefits, it's very important to understand that vaccination will help. I always recommend patients, workers, employees should have a one-to-one discussion with their treating provider and get to a more appropriate conclusion of how to safely protect themselves.
It sounds like the best offense is going to be a good defense. We should continue to mask wear, social distance, hand wash, and receive the vaccine.
Correct. So we can do everything in our capacity to minimize risk and transmission of the disease. And I think there's also a need where individuals with these underlying conditions like weakened immune systems or autoimmune conditions need to be closely looked at long-term to see if these vaccines actually, which is a messenger RNA vaccines, a newer kind of vaccines, these disease or these conditions might not impact that much. But again, that understanding is still limited and evolving.
Sure.
There's other things that we have seen with the flu vaccinations. And one important thing is Guillain-Barré syndrome that is commonly reported in vaccination campaigns. We don't have a good understanding yet. So those individuals need to work with their treating provider to see if they can get the vaccine. To date, we have no cases of GBS, Guillain-Barré syndrome, for COVID-19 vaccines. The other thing that I want to highlight here is vaccine itself prevents the acquisition of infection, which means that it prevents you from getting the disease. Does not necessarily we understand that it actually prevents the spread of the infection, which is an important distinction that one can make. So vaccine itself protects one, but vaccine, as of now, we don't know if it prevents the spread of the disease.
So you could still be an asymptomatic carrier and spread it.
True. So that's important for all of us to continue to wear a mask, continue to socially distance, avoid crowds, wash our hands diligently, avoid traveling and transmitting the disease, even post-vaccination. I'm hopeful that at some point we will have enough information to determine that after vaccination, we can reduce the transmission of infection from one person to another.
How is that with flu?
So we do know that vaccination itself reduces the intensity of flu. Getting vaccinated also prevents the transmission of infection from one person to another. There's good news, and I'm hopeful that is the same for COVID-19 vaccines as well.
That would be good news indeed.
One of the things that it's important for us to talk about is this reluctance to get vaccinated, the fear of unknown, or not knowing what happens. And it's a challenging discussion for both the patients, workers, employees, and for physicians. I have these conversations on a regular basis. And one thing that I always talk about is we need to look at this particular disease, which has a tendency of creating long-term health effects and also increase in mortality or death. It's important for us to protect ourselves, our loved ones. So vaccinating, even though we do not know long-term effects, it's prudent for us to think about protecting us against this devastating disease. The conversation I always have is grounded in realistic expectations. We need to be forthcoming and really simplified our understanding of the vaccine as well as disease, and also make sure that these conversations are grounded on the facts that we know as of now. And as our understanding evolves, we can certainly educate our patients better in terms of the impact or side effect of these vaccines long term.
Is there survey data or poll data showing how many Americans are planning to get vaccinated?
The initial surveys looked at a number of Americans interested or plan to get SARS vaccine. It was about 50%, close to about 50%, which is a low number. As the rollout continues, I think, and the efficacy of the vaccine has been up to 95%, I think that has changed the dynamics even more. There are more people are interested. I know for a fact that healthcare workers here who have been offered vaccinations are excited and are willing to take this vaccine. Most of us are moving forward and trying to protect ourselves from this disease.
Hopefully those numbers will continue to go up.
Right. And the other part is the vaccine is currently under emergency use authorization. So it's not a mandatory vaccine. We don't mandate it to be taken, at least in healthcare settings. People have a choice of taking the vaccine or not. There's also American Disability Act and Civil Rights Act of 1964 does help certain individuals who are reluctant to take the vaccine as well. But looking at the devastation of the disease, the pandemic that has been prevalent across the country, and sheer misery of the patients suffering from the disease, I feel that vaccination will really help in terms of minimizing the infection among different groups. And since healthcare workers have been dealing with this disease on the front lines, I think I can speak for my colleagues who have seen this devastation very closely and feel that we all need to be vaccinated to protect each other.
And even if we can't have a federal mandate of a vaccine, individual industries can certainly have requirements that would make it so, you know, you have to have a vaccine passport or something before you're allowed to board an airplane or whatever.
Yeah, and I know an interesting point, Aaron. And airline industry have mentioned that, at least I heard in the media, the person need to be vaccinated for traveling. It's not unprecedented either. In certain parts of the world, we have seen there's certain requirements to get vaccine. For example, yellow fever vaccines and others are required. In a religious travel such as Hajj in Saudi Arabia, the vaccination to meningitis is required. So there's certain times that we have required a vaccination for traveling. So I don't think that it's completely unprecedented to not expect that in the near future. But again, going back to the point that this particular vaccine is approved under emergency use authorization, we also need to get additional information about the safety of vaccines. The other thing that has been really interesting is to understand that if healthcare providers or practitioners basically have a conversations with patients' employees, they're more likely to show willingness. There's some questions about pregnancy and breastfeeding moms to get the vaccine. Again, the information on these conditions are still limited. Discussion with the healthcare provider and determining risk versus benefits might be helpful in making a right conclusion in terms of vaccination.
So speaking of vaccines, I know we have the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines out. Are we getting closer to other companies getting the emergency use authorization to have mass production in the United States?
Yeah, some very encouraging signs. I think another company, which is Johnson & Johnson, their group Janssen, is currently working on a vaccine, which hopefully will be available at least for review from the FDA. It's a different kind of vaccine. It uses an adenovirus-based vaccine. The good news about that particular vaccine, it's a single dose vaccine and could be stored at a relatively cooler temperature, not as cool as we require it for messenger RNA vaccine, but at a refrigerator level. I also heard that England has approved the second vaccine, which is Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, based on a similar technology as Jensen or Johnson & Johnson. It also uses adenovirus. Efficacy for that particular vaccine is reaching up to close to about 69 to 70%.
Oh, that's nowhere near as high as the mRNA vaccines.
Correct. But again, it's a different types, a different kind of vaccine. Putting it in more perspective, the flu shot in most cases gives you up to 50% immunity against the disease. So really? Anything beyond 50% is a very good news in terms of vaccine efficacy.
That's an important perspective. I don't think that I knew that the flu vaccine was only 50% effective.
Yes. And it's some years it has been lower than that. It's imperative for us to talk about the vulnerable workers or people with huge economic disparities. I think that's very important for them to feel comfortable, safe. That's where we see the most devastation of this disease. They have significant comorbidities. Other medical conditions should not prevent them from getting the vaccine. This conversation summarizes very well what we know and what we don't know about the vaccine. Hopefully in near future, with additional individuals taking the vaccine, we have a very good comprehensive knowledge of the efficacy is of this particular vaccines against COVID-19 disease in individuals who suffers from multiple medical conditions. Anyway, so we will end with the fact, in order to control the epidemic or pandemic, we need to do our part. We need to educate our patients, and we need to make sure our message is grounded in facts. As more additional information is available, we can certainly communicate that back to our patients or to our employees, and including the employers who are willing to help improve vaccination rates across communities and across industries. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dr. Nabil. Appreciate your expertise.